Well, it's getting near the middle of the week. Everybody still with us? Get filled up on coffee and cookies and tea? Oh, yes. Well, I hope you're finding the study of the angels as exciting as I have. I really like the subject. And really, my goal this week wasn't to cover every passage about angels. I'd need all three classes, I think, to do that. Instead, what my goal was to just whet your appetite for the fact that when you're doing the readings in the future, you'll have a lot more things to look at and things to consider and try to take some of these Bible stories from the perspective of angels and try to figure out, like, what were they thinking? What were they trying to accomplish? And do it from the perspective of this is what we hope to do in the age to come. And who knows beyond that. So it's fun from that perspective. I told Scott back there that I would make sure that you all knew that when I mentioned about the MP3s and the classes being uploaded and all that, that it was only my classes, because I happen to be recording them on a little MP3 player right there. And that make sure you sign up for the CDs for all the other classes. And those of you that like CDs, make sure you get them. I think what's happening in our world is that the younger people that are growing up are now getting used to all this new technology. I get it all from my kids over there. They show me all the cool things that are out. And it's nice technology, but if you don't know how to use it, then you still pop the CDs in the car. And I'll bet some of you are still pushing play on the recorders, aren't you? Yeah, I knew that. That's okay. At least it works. And that's the thing, is to keep trying whatever we can find that works. So, the angels. There were a couple of things yesterday that I didn't get to that we'll just throw in right now. But when we were looking at the power and the authority of the angels, the power and the authority yesterday, just a couple of other things that you'll see about the power that they are entrusted with. You can remember one of the famous ones was in 2 Kings 19 at verse 35, when they were working with the Assyrians and chasing them on back, and you know, God had told Hezekiah, I'll take care of you, and an angel of the Lord, you know, it says an angel of the Lord, one angel, went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. You know, and in the end, if you trace that through, you can see how they took care of Sennacherib too when he got home. So, you know, whether that was just an angel or whether it was an angel who was assigned the job, who worked with other angels, whatever it was, they took care of. That's a lot, 185,000 in one night. So that's the kind of authority and power that they have. In Daniel chapter 4, when Nebuchadnezzar was looking over all the stuff, and he gets that pride in his heart, sort of like Herod later on in Acts 12, and he's thinking about all the things that he had built, then the angel's decision at that point, when Nebuchadnezzar was turned into an animal, you notice the way the text reads, it says the decision was by decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones. See, though there's sometimes we just read over those things and we don't even notice they're there, but these were angels involved in making decisions at this point, and Nebuchadnezzar was turned into a beast for the 7 years. And in Acts chapter 12, you see the same thing with Herod. When Herod was, the people were shouting, the voice of the God, and in Acts 12 at verse 23, the voice of a God and not of a man, that immediately an angel of the Lord struck him, because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died. So those are the kind of, you know, when you look at the authority and the power of the angels, these are the kind of decisions that they can make. And they do end up, they're being allowed to make some decisions here about how they're going to carry out things and accomplish the end result. So God gives them parameters to work with. They all know what the big game plan is, and he tells them all that. But some of the specifics along the way, they have to work their way along and make some decisions about how they're going to carry this stuff out. So, and it's a warning to all of us of being careful that the angels know what we're thinking. They don't have to wait until Herod says that, but they know what we're thinking. And so we got to be careful about taking God's glory on for ourselves, judging others, or speaking unkind words, because the angels hear all these things. And that's not what they want from us. They want us to give God the glory and not take it for ourselves. But for all of their power and authority, what really fascinates me is that angels never let it go to their head. Yeah, and you know, with human people today, this so often happens. Our politicians, our leaders in the world, you see this so often. Sports people that are given a lot of publicity, and then you find out that they've had children out of wedlock and they've done all kinds of crazy things that they should have never done. And almost it's like they think they're above the law sometimes and they're beyond the law. And angels aren't like that. When people try to worship them, you see in Revelation 19 at verse 10, and John falls at his feet to worship them. The angel says to him, see that you don't do that. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Jesus. Or again, in Revelation 22 at verse 9, you see that, again, the same kind of thing, that he doesn't want them to worship him. See that you don't do that, for I'm your fellow servant and of your brethren, the prophets, and those who keep the words of this book. And so angels, when we become angels, God willing, it's not going to be something where you can let this go to your head. God has to make sure that we're not going to be the kind of people that are full of pride and will let this thing destroy us in the end. We've got to be keeping those things under control and fighting them in this life, and in the end, we won't have to battle with them anymore. Now, for today's class, I want to look at how the angels work for us. And I was always impressed at Paul's use of this in Hebrews chapter 1, because you remember when Paul wrote the letter to the Hebrews, he's trying so desperately to balance out what Jesus Christ can do for you more than Moses and Joshua and the Levitical priesthood and even the angels. But he has to do it with the angels in such a gentle way that he isn't tearing the angels down. He's simply showing how Christ is above the angels and can do for you things that angels could not do. And so in Hebrews chapter 1, he goes through all those pains of quoting those Old Testament passages in order to establish that fact that God was going to have a son, and the son was going to be his only son, and he was going to entrust this son so that when he again brings the firstborn into the world, let all the angels of God worship him. And he ends up Hebrews chapter 1, before he gets into 2, where he'll deal with why the angels were less, they were under Christ, because they could not save us. Jesus Christ can. And he lays that out in chapter 2 beautifully. But at the end of chapter 1, he then throws in a line there at the end of the chapter about the angels. So after he's shown that Christ is above the angels, his comment is that, look at, the angels, are not they all ministering spirits? And here's their mission. They're sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation. They were never sent to save you. They can't do that. Jesus Christ does that. But angels could not save. All they could do is work within the parameters that God had given them, try to bring human people to a point where they develop faith in Jesus Christ. And that's the role of the angels, to minister for those who will inherit salvation. But what a great privileged position to have that role. And, you know, if that is the role of the angels, that is what they do now. And this is what we hope to do with the mortals in the kingdom age. Then we've got to start this now. This isn't just something that's going to all of a sudden begin when God gives people immortality. This is a way of life that people have. It's an attitude of mind where we go back home to our families and ecclesias, and we try to become those who minister for our children, for our elderly, for our families, for our ecclesial members, and for the friends out there that we preach to, for those who will inherit salvation, because that's what angels do. And we want to be like those angels. I threw a note in down there that we'll look at one of the classes later on this week, that when you go back and look at some of our Christadelphian Bible marking lessons, like the West Coast lessons, or when you look through our hymn book, it's a little disappointing sometimes to find that we really got a lot influenced in our hymn book by the hymns of the Protestant churches of this world, in which you'll see that most of our hymns, if you think about it, what do angels do in the hymns? You remember, like, when you think back over all the hymns, you know, what does it usually say angels are doing in hymns? What are they doing? Singing, right? And it's interesting that we've sort of like brought that in from the Christianity at large out there. But most of our hymns just attribute to angels, they sing. Well, now for those of you that like to sing and you want to be part of the heavenly choir, that's good. Those of us that aren't good singers, have no voice or whatever, we think, oh, I hope there's more than singing. Either that or we hope we get a better voice. But angels do a lot more than singing. So that's a part of their work, but it's certainly not the whole thing. Now, Psalm 34. You got to turn this one up. Psalm 34. This is one of my favorites about angels and about the whole concept of a way of life. In Psalm 34. Psalm 34, this passage, you hear this quoted all the time. You'll see it on plaques all over the place, that the angel of the Lord encamps around all those who fear him and delivers them. Nice, simple little saying that we can throw. Bob Lloyd probably would put those, you know, and put them on your car and stick them on your fridge and, you know, all those kind of things like that. Right? I mean, this is one of those common sayings. And it's good. It's a nice, comforting saying. Now, have you ever looked at the heading of Psalm 34 to find out the context? Context, 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 right? You want to know where things come from. So you read, like in our Bibles there, the New King James has for its heading, a Psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Ooh, now when was that? When he feigned madness before, oh, Abimelech's just a king there. It was actually Achish. And you go back into the Samuel account. You remember what happened in David's life? He had been anointed the king of Israel. He shows up into Saul's court, and it gets to where Saul's so jealous, and all he wants to do is throw spears at him and kill him. And then Saul, you know, at that point, and Jonathan finally realizes, well, David better get out of the kingdom at that point, at least get out of the city. And then David tries to hide out in different places around the city. And Saul sends messengers out through the whole country, and he tells all the cities, if you see David, you better let me know, or I'm going to come in and wipe out your city. And David's under pressure. He can't go anywhere. Remember when the Ziphites were going to give him up? It's just the pressure was on. Saul had intimidated the country. Where can he go? Goes over to the Philistines. Now imagine you're in David's shoes. You're walking over to the Philistines. You're walking over there to a country where everybody knows you. This is Israel's giant killer. This is their champion, the guy that killed our Goliath. And he's walking over there, and he comes up with a plan. Now, in the Samuel account, when you read it in Samuel, all it does is tell you David's plan. He came up with this idea, and you remember what it was. He decided that if he's going to have to go to the Philistines, he better have a plan. Otherwise, they'll kill him. And so what he does is he goes in, makes a plan, and his plan is, I'm not going to hide from them. I'm just going to be right out front. I'm going to walk in there, and they're going to see me. And he comes up with this plan of just fake madness. I'll pretend I'm a madman. I'm insane. And he lets the spittle run down his face, and he probably wouldn't talk funny. And he just acted like he was insane. And you read the Samuel account, and you just think, oh, that was a cool plan. I bet he thought that was really great. And David had come up with that. He's such a smart guy. And you read all that stuff in Samuel. When you read the Psalms, you find out here's what he's really thinking in Psalm 34. And he blesses the Lord at all times in verse 1, and his praise will continually be in his mouth. And because he realizes in verse 2 that the humble shall hear of it and be glad. And he doesn't go around telling everybody what a great plan I made and you see how it worked and all that. This is David's attitude. The whole time he's going through this, in his mind, when he's feigning madness before Achish, he's talking to God, he's praying to God, he's aware of the angels that's with him, and he's hoping that God will bless his plan and deliver him from this king that could have easily killed him and put up David's head in front of everybody and just triumphed that through the Philistine country. And the plan worked, and David gave thanks to God. And it's a great reminder to all of us, brothers and sisters, that the angels that are with us, it's the same way in our lives. When we go home from Bible school, and we have to make plans about our ecclesias, our families, our jobs, our neighborhood, our preaching efforts, whatever we're doing, we don't do this from the perspective of, look at what I did, and look at what I accomplished. We do it with God in mind, with the angel that's walking with us, talking to them and hoping and praying that they will bless our efforts and they'll do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. This is what angels do. And this angel took care of David before Achish and blessed his efforts, and Achish let him go. And he let him walk out of there, and then David set up camp in the Philistine country, raided the Philistines and left nobody alive and kept sending word back that he was raiding other countries. It's a great plan. It's amazing how it worked. But David all along had, in his own mind, he's very much aware of how the angels had helped him out. Now, in contrast to that is 2 Chronicles 16. In 2 Chronicles 16, if you just flip back there, this is the story about, as our Sunday school lessons called him, Good King Asa. Now, 2 Chronicles 16 is, we'll just pick it up partway through Asa's reign. Asa, now this is interesting in terms of Ed's classes, because I really believe that when you look back at Jehoshaphat, I just heard a glimpse when I walked in at the end of your class, Ed, you're hearing about his unity efforts up there in the north. But when you look at what happened with Jehoshaphat, Asa was his dad, you know, and Asa, what he had done is you're going to see right here, Asa had made some mistakes, cost him his life, cost him his spiritual life, and I really think in the end Jehoshaphat learned from that and decided, I'm not going to do that, and so he takes a whole different approach towards unity. So what Asa had done earlier in his life, you remember early on, Asa had a problem. The Ethiopians down there before Egypt had come up with a million-man army. A million men, and they had chariots too. And they came up to invade southern Judah. And at that point, Asa just laid it out before God and said, "Help me out. There's nothing we can do. We'll never stop this." And God delivered him from a million-man army. And then Asa set out to do reforms and do all kinds of good things in the land. But then, as time went on, a different problem developed in Asa's life. Instead of the Ethiopians down there coming up, or the Syrians up there coming in, Asa had a problem with his own brethren, the northern kingdom. In Baasha, the king in the north, the northern kingdom up there, Baasha, right along the border between Judah and the northern kingdom, Baasha starts pushing down. And he starts taking more countries, so that when you look normally across the border was dipping down like this. And Baasha is pushing down into the south, and he's taking some of the border cities of Judah. And he's building up fortified cities down there. And Asa must have realized that, whoa, this is a little different. This isn't like fighting with the Ethiopians. This is like within the community. This is like the brotherhood. And he comes at it in a totally different spirit. And so what he does this time is he decides, all right, I can't just go fight with them. I don't want to do that. They're my brother. And he decides what I'll do is I'll go up to the king of Syria, remind him about the old treaties we used to have, and say, hey, let's make another treaty with Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and have him come down and cause trouble for Baasha. And then Baasha will leave me alone because I have problems on the north. I'll have to take his army up there, and then I'll take care of the south, and I'll go back and take those cities and just destroy them and refortify my territory. So that was Asa's plan. Now, did it work? Did it work? Did Ben-Hadad come down? Did he bother the northern kingdom? Did Baasha have to pull out his troops and go up there and support the north up there? And then could Asa then come back up there and rip apart those cities? Sure, it worked. But what a difference in attitude between Asa and David. And so Hanani comes to him in verse 7. After all this is over, and the plan worked, and he probably went back and said, ooh, was that great how that worked out. You know, just like everything happened just like I hoped. And you can imagine how he was just reveling this at the time of what a great plan how this had worked out. And back in verse 8, you can see there that when Ben-Hadad heard it, he stopped building Ramah, ceased his work, and King Asa took all Judah, and they carried away the stones and timbers of Ramah that Baasha had been building up, which Baasha had used for building, and with them he built Geba and Mizpah. So, oh, what a plan! But then Hanani, the prophet, comes to him. And he came to Asa, and he said, look it, because you have relied on the king of Syria and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand. You could have had the north and you could have had the Syrians if you'd relied on God. But he didn't. He handled it within the community a different way. It's an interesting problem and a perspective about, you know, how we treat our brethren versus those that are from the outside. So in verse 8, he reminds them, look at, weren't the Ethiopians and the Lumim, that was that old, that huge million-man army, weren't they a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. And there's that passage that you hear quoted a lot. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. And this you've done foolishly, therefore from now on you're going to have wars. Now, look at Asa could have responded to that and said, oh, I blew it, I'm sorry, I made a huge mistake, but our good King Asa, there's not a good thing written about him the rest of his life. And all you hear about him from here on in is bad, bad, bad stuff. This probably cost him his spiritual life, and Jehoshaphat grew up with this, realizing this had destroyed his dad. And now what he does instead is he takes Hanani in verse 10 there, he throws him into prison, he's angry with him, he oppressed some of the people at that time, and then the angels tried to work with him. They gave him a disease in his feet. They may have given him something like gout to try to bring him back. But all we hear about that in all of this, in his disease, he did not seek the Lord but the physicians in order for his cure. And that's all you hear about Asa at this point. It's sort of sad to watch that happen. But what a contrast between David, who's going in there before Achish, aware of the angels walking in with him, and relying on God to solve his problem, versus Asa. And you know what we got to do is just think about ourselves and our own lives. You know, how much are we like Asa? Where we plan things out, we scheme. We're sort of like Jacob and Rebecca. We scheme our way through life and think, ooh, wow, that worked really good. And then we try another scheme. And then eventually God has to teach us that it's not our scheming. It's angels that are taking care of things for us. And hopefully as time goes on, we rely more and more on angels and less upon our own human schemes. But you'll notice that what Hananiah reminded Asa is that the eyes of the Lord, the angels, they're out there throughout the whole earth, and they're taking care of those to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. That's the qualifier that you're going to see all along. For those who are heirs of salvation, they will inherit salvation. The ones whose hearts are loyal. And you'll see this as a common thing as you're going through this today. The angels are out there helping us. They are there to help us through life. But they can only do it if our hearts are loyal to God. Look at how this shows up in Daniel 3. Remember the story with Nebuchadnezzar and the three friends. He threw them in the fiery furnace. He saw the fourth one walking, and the form was like the Son of God's. And he realizes there was somebody else in there. And so Nebuchadnezzar spoke in verse 28, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him." You see, that's the qualifier. They trusted in God, and the angels work for those who act like that. They have trust in God, faith in God. They're depending on him to solve the problems, not just our own scheming. And they frustrated the king's word. They yielded their bodies and trusted God. No matter what happened, they said, whether we get saved or whether we don't get saved, whatever God does in this is going to be right. And that's the kind of faith and trust they had. And angels work for those people. You see it again in Daniel 6 when Daniel's thrown into the lion's den. You know, and the king's all upset and Belshazzar's wondering, like, did he make it? He comes back in the morning, takes the stone off and yells down there, "Daniel, is your God able to deliver you?" And he says, "Sure, my God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths so that they have not hurt me because I was found innocent. Innocent before God, and I was also innocent before you, king. I didn't do anything wrong." So the angels of the Lord encamp around those who fear him, those who trust in him, those who are innocent before God. That doesn't mean sinless. It means you're innocent because you're trying to walk as a member of God's family. And he'll forgive the mistakes that you make. He just wants you to be on board as part of his team. And for those people, he sends his angels. Now, you remember Psalm 91, that Satan quoted that to Jesus during the temptation. But the psalm was written from the perspective that, yes, he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. And you reflect back over all the Bible stories you can think of where angels did that, like with David or with Joseph, all the things that Joseph went through in prison and his events in Egypt. There's so many Bible stories you can go back and reflect on about how God sent his angels. He gave them charge over you to take care of you and keep you in all your ways. And Satan knew that was such a true thing that that it comes up in the temptation. And he throws it out at Jesus and says, "Look, you can go up to the pinnacle of the temple, throw yourself off, and he'll take care of you." But what we want to learn from that is although the angels do encamp around those who fear him and delivers them, that doesn't mean we can just throw ourselves into ridiculous situations and expect God's going to take care of us. That isn't how it works. We don't just purposely leave the Bible school and speed home at 100 miles an hour and just figure, "Well, I have angels with me, and I'll be okay." That's not how life works. And we don't just purposely move places and go and do things just figuring, "Well, I have angels with me, and they'll take care of me." The angels take care of those who are walking as members of God's family, who live within the scope and the realm of his commands and are obedient to him, and who have learned to live by faith. That's who they're out there helping. You are the ones who are the heirs of salvation that they have been sent to take care of. And so the angels take good care of us in all those things. Now, look at another case of angels taking care of people. And you look at the sense in which they've been sent to help and serve those who are heirs of salvation. Remember the frustrations Daniel had in Daniel chapter 9. He knew he's at the end of the 70 years. He's praying that this has got to be the right time. And he's looking for God's deliverance. And what he gets is, like in chapter 8, you get that vision of the he-goat kind of thing, and it's a bit frustrating. He doesn't really know what's coming on the community. And what happens in verse 21 is that while he's praying in Daniel 9 and pleading that God will forgive the community and trying to intercede for them, the man Gabriel, we know that's an angel, who I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, because that's probably the only way they could understand it, as angels move from one area to another. He shows up so fast, he figures, wow, that must have been a quick flight. But really, it's just angels can move. They can move interdimensionally, or whatever it takes to get from heaven to here, whatever that is. And it doesn't take any time at all. And he reached me about the time of the evening offering. He informed me and talked with me, and he said, "Oh, Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand." So here's another rule that angels do in helping us to understand God's word and understand God's plan. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out. See, this is the divine heavenly counsel, is how it works. And the prayers of Daniel went up to heaven, and the command went out, either from God or from, it probably was right in the heavenly counsel. He sends Gabriel, go down there and help Daniel understand this. And so the command goes out, and he comes to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. I mean, this is what angels work for. Daniel is greatly beloved. His life was walking with God, walking by faith, and the angels were out there working for him. You see, back in Daniel 8, in the chapter before, when after he had seen the vision of the he-goat, and he's all frustrated over what's happening, and he's wondering, and what I find interesting about this one is that, angels can give visions to humans, and they see the vision. And then the angels sort of step back themselves and they wonder, wow, what's that about? Because they don't necessarily know all that. They know how to help Daniel see the vision, or they watch another angel do that. But then when they see the vision, they're not sure either what it means. And you see this in Daniel chapter 8 at verse 13. Anytime you see angels talking to angels, just watch that and read it carefully. So in verse 13, he heard a holy one speaking, who was probably Michael, one of the higher ranking angels. And another holy one said to that certain holy one who was speaking, "How long will this vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of the desolation of giving both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" Here's an angel concerned about God's people, working probably with people in the land of Israel, and he sees this vision and knows Daniel's got this vision now about the holy city being trampled down. The sanctuary is going to be overrun. And he's wondering, how long is that going to be? I mean, they're already up in Babylon right now, and now how long is this going to go on? And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." So here's an angel talking, and getting information. Then it happened, and when Daniel had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. So now Daniel's seen the vision, and now he's starting to wonder, like, what in the world is this? He's seen this vision. He doesn't understand it either. And so I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called out and said, "Gabriel." So here we go again. Gabriel's going to get involved. "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So here's an angel, probably Michael, asking another angel, probably Gabriel in this case here. We've got Gabriel. "Gabriel, would you help Daniel understand this?" And so Gabriel does and helps him understand the vision. This is a great example of angels working with angels and showing you how some have higher understanding than others. Now, in Isaiah 63, this passage, maybe it would be better to link them in with some of the ones that were happening back in the time of Moses, but it's interesting to look back at this event. Isaiah 63, time-wise, you're like right before the Babylonian captivity, and Isaiah's looking back in prophecy at all the things that God did for the community in bringing them out of Egypt, and all the trouble they had to go through, and all the affliction, some of the plagues, and all the trouble with bringing them out of Egypt, and wandering for the 40 years, and the serpents that bit them when they were down there in the south before they came up in the land, even at the end of the 40 years. And he's looking at this and realizing that, in the same way that God had to let those things happen to the community back then, it wasn't because he hated them, it was because he wanted to save them. And now Isaiah's foreseeing the time in which his people are going to go into captivity up to Babylon, and they're going to go through a lot of these same troubles. But he wants them to realize that when God destroys Jerusalem, it's not like he enjoys it. The angels that came in and did it, they're not saying, "Yes, we got to wipe this city out." It's because they love you, and they want to save those who are the heirs of salvation. So in all their affliction, he was afflicted. he was afflicted as well. And the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity, he redeemed them, and he bore them and carried them all the days of old. You see, that's when he sent the angel of his presence to help them, wandering through the wilderness. God was feeling this like they were feeling it. It's not something he enjoyed. Even when you look at this in terms of like what he was going to send his own son through, what God was to bring Jesus through, it's not like he enjoyed all of that. He enjoyed the result of what it was going to accomplish. But in all of his affliction, God was afflicted as well. And that's what happens with the angels. They feel it. God feels it. The angels feel it. And they still have those emotions. And they're part of those family extensions of God himself. And they've learned to live and feel like God. And that's the way we'll be in the kingdom. We won't lose those kind of feelings. You look in 1 Corinthians 4, just to see another example of this kind of thing of angels being afflicted and seeing some of the things that go on. The Apostle Paul, you know, when he tells the Corinthians about all the things that he's had to suffer, lashes from the Jews, the 39 lashes. I've been shipwrecked at sea, left floating. You know, I've been so many days without any food. I've hungered and thirsted. And he goes through all the different things that he's had to go through as a preacher of the gospel, to take the gospel to the Gentiles. In verse 9 of chapter 4, "For I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to death, for we have been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men." Now, an interesting concept that Paul would understand that, of looking at it from the perspective of angels, watching the things that he had to go through, and realizing that, wow, this is what it takes. And you can imagine how they felt going through what Christ went through. And angels waiting 4,000 years to try to figure out how are we ever going to save this race. And God sends his son, and then his son has to suffer all these things and be treated the way he was treated. And from the angels' perspective, this isn't something they enjoy. This is frustrating to them. This is like disgusting that this has to happen. But in all their affliction, he was afflicted. And they see it, and some of the things that we go through, it's a spectacle both to angels and to men. Now, some of the missions that angels are sent on in order to work for the heirs of salvation, some of them involve destruction. And that's a perspective that, you know, the angels have to have. That in order to find the good in the end, there are some times where there has to be some bad. And you'll see that in the case of like David, when he had numbered the people, and the angel gives him three choices through the prophet Gad. He says, look, you've got three choices. You can either have 3 years of famine, 3 months to be defeated by your foes with the sword overtaking you, or else three days for the sword of the Lord. Now, I asked the kids this morning, like, you know, why do you think David picked the 3 days with the sword of the Lord devouring them? And they said, well, that was because it was only 3 days instead of 3 months. And that was an interesting answer, but that isn't really what the context shows. Why did David pick the 3 days? Well, he tells us, because in verse 13, David said to Gad, "I'm in great distress. Please let me fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are very great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man." And so the Lord sent the plague upon Israel. Now, you can come up with all the reasons in the world why you think this may have happened. Why did David ever do this? You know, within the law, it was legal to number those that were 20 years old and upward, all the males. It appears that at this point, David numbered everybody in the community. Now, you can try to figure out, well, why did he do that? You know, that was against the law. But it is possible that when you look at the context of where he's at in his life, that David may have been trying to collect as much money as possible for the building of the temple and thought that this would be a great way to increase the shekel tax and bring in funds into the community. But whatever it was, once he had done it, immediately, I mean, even Joab knew it. You can't do this. And as soon as David had done it, he realized it was a mistake. But there are consequences. Sure, God will forgive him of the mistake, but now there's going to be things that happen. And probably God was seeking an event with the people anyways. So God sent an angel. He sends an angel to Jerusalem in 1 Chronicles 21 at verse 15 to destroy it. Now, you can imagine if you were that angel, you would not have enjoyed that job. You're going down there to destroy some of the very people that your fellow angels had been working with day by day. That's not a fun job. But it was part of what was necessary to save those who were the heirs of salvation at this point. And as he's destroying, the Lord looked and relented of the disaster. And he says to the angel who was destroying, "That's enough. You know, restrain your hand. You can put your sword back in your sheath at this point. Because the angel was standing there with his sword drawn, representing the plague that was going on across the community. Now that's interesting because the angel who was sent to destroy Jerusalem, he didn't know how far to take the plague. See, when you start looking at what angels know and what they don't know, all he knew is you're supposed to take this plague out and you take it across Jerusalem, and he's doing it and probably thrilled when he finally gets the message, you can quit. So in verse 16 there, David lifted up his eyes and he saw the angel of the Lord standing between heaven and earth with in his hand a drawn sword stretched out over Jerusalem. And so David and the elders, they clothed in sackcloth, they fell on their faces. And David says to God, was it not I who commanded the people to be numbered? And he tries to take the responsibility on himself. And he prays to God, you know, on the behalf of the sheep, your hand, O Lord, let it be on me, my God, against me and my father's house, but not against your people, that they should be plagued. Which is a great positive attitude for David to have. And so the angel of the Lord now commanded Gad to say to David. So now you have like how this works. You know, God sent an angel out to take care of the situation. The angel talks to the prophet. The prophet then talks to David. And he meets him at the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite there and tells him to erect an altar at that point. So David went up at the word of Gad, which he'd spoken in the name of the Lord. And Ornan sees the angel there. You know, imagine us if we saw the angel there and they just had brought this plague in. We'd probably be like Ornan's sons. They'd take off and run. But Ornan didn't. He just kept working away over there, wondering what the angel was going to do, probably. And so the Lord commanded the angel to return his sword to his sheath. And at that point then, David, what's interesting in this whole story is that not just the story of the angels, but that event in David's life, and when you read through the count and Chronicles there, the very next thing David then does is he figures out, wow, now I know where to build the temple. And you look back at that event and you try to figure out, he was trying to put those pieces together all along. And now he is up there on Mount Moriah on the threshing floor of Ornan, right in that area there, and he realizes this is where God wants it. He wants it here in Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem became his central focus point at that point, and knew that the temple was to be built there. Now, another case of where angels had to do some destructive things was Exodus 12, when they went forth and they struck all the firstborn of Egypt. You know, you could imagine what that was like, and going through and destroying those. In Psalm 79, when it refers back at some of the events where God had to send angels to destroy people, both the outsiders and also within his community, especially when he probably was destroying with the plagues, and you have like the serpents that bit them. In Numbers, he cast on them in Psalm 78 and verse 49 the fierceness of his anger, wrath, indignation, and trouble by sending angels of destruction among them. Now those aren't evil angels, as some of your Bibles say. There are no evil angels. These are angels that brought evil events. Or as a lot of Bibles render this, they're just angels of destruction. And they were the ones that were destroying in this case. So the angels were willing at this point. That's an attitude of mind we have to come to about people. We can't just be the kind of pacifist that would never destroy anybody to be a member of God's family. You know, we're out to seek the glory of God and obey him and do his commands. And there are going to be times, probably in the kingdom age as well, where people are going to have to be judged for mistakes that they've made. People are going to have to be destroyed when the kingdom is set up. And that's part of an attitude we have to have in realizing that we're there ministering for the sake of those who are heirs of salvation, not for just all the people of this world. And some of them, the angels had to destroy. Now, a sad case is in Judges 5. Judges 5, remember Deborah and Barak. You know, Deborah and Barak finally got together the courage. They're going to go out and they're going to take on Jabin, all right, the king of the Canaanites. Sisera, his leading commander. All right, and so Barak, you know, is a bit hesitant. Deborah stirs them up, but together they got the group together to go out and fight Jabin. And they sent the message out within the community to come and help. Now, it's really interesting that in Deborah's song, in Judges chapter 5, you know, one of the least places you'd expect to see anything about angels, maybe, but when she's recounting this, she looks and says, curse Miraz, in verse 23, said the angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants bitterly, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, the help of the Lord against the mighty. And on the other hand, here's Jael, who got carried out by Heber out into the like isolation, you know, and she's out there, and Sisera comes over to her, and man, she's probably shaken in her shoes, you know, scared, but living by faith, realizing that God had put her in a situation where she can solve the problem. and she puts Sisera in the tent, gives him the milk, and then takes the tent peg and kills him. You know, and what a contrast between those who live by faith versus those who just don't want to get involved. They're not going to help out. And it's certainly a warning to all of us, brethren and sisters, that when our ecclesias need us, when families need us, when there are opportunities for us to serve in the truth and be involved in God's work, we don't want angels looking back at our life and saying, well, curse this brother, curse this sister, because they didn't even come to help. And that's the frustration some angels have at this point, where they thought, surely everybody's going to help. We're going to pull this off. We're going to win this victory. And other people didn't even have an awareness of angels working at all. Wouldn't even come to help, because they probably didn't even realize angels were really there. Now, in Acts chapter 7, I want to finish up today, which is looking at some of the events in Abraham's life. And whatever we don't get to today, we'll finish up tomorrow and pick it up in Lot. But Abraham's life is fun to look at from the perspective of angels, as you just carry it right on through. And we find out that when angels, the first time we know of at least, when they appeared to Abraham, Stephen actually tells us, not Genesis. He said, and when Stephen gave and started off his speech in Acts 7, "Brethren and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran." So this was way back over in the end of the Fertile Crescent, over in Mesopotamia, before he actually went up to Haran, which is where you pick him up like in Genesis 11 and 12, when you have the promises made. So God first appeared to him there through the angels and told him to get out of his country from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you. So that's interesting because, you know, sometimes we think that it's all started up later on, but it actually started right from the beginning. So in Genesis 12, when God talks to Abraham in verse 1 there, then the Lord had said to Abraham. That's actually what's there in the Hebrew, not the Lord said to Abraham, but the Lord had said, and he's looking back at this event previously, at least, and it's not really when he's up in Haran up there, it's probably previously, get out of your country from your family and your father's house to a land that I will show you. We would have never known that, really, if it hadn't been for Stephen helping us out. "And I'll make of you a great nation and bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you," and so on. So in verse 4, Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken to him, which we now know is probably an angel appearing to Abraham and talking with him. And he's 75 years old when he departed from Haran. See, that's Haran now, verse 4. But 5 years earlier, he had actually been in Mesopotamia. And now his dad has died, and he's now going to leave Haran and come on down to the south. That, by the way, is how you figure out all those years, the 430 years versus the extra 5 years in Galatians. It actually comes from the 5 years previously when he had been over there in Mesopotamia. So it all really does hang together and make sense. For all the numbers people, where's Jeff? He's a numbers person. Then the Lord said to him in chapter 15, we find out that the Lord spoke to him in chapter 15. So now we're a little bit later on, the promises have been given. And he says to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit." So he's reflecting back to the very beginning. All right, and he said, "Lord, how shall I know, Lord God, how will I know that I will inherit?" And he said, "Bring me," all right, this is bring me right here, "a 3-year-old heifer." Now, see, to say that, you know, an angel is talking with him, and he's going through all this with an angel. Bring me, so the angel would probably appear to him right there on the spot, the 3-year-old female goat and a pigeon. And so the angel had asked Abraham to leave Ur of the Chaldees, promised to work with him and his family, you know, if he would believe, and Abraham simply believed. He believed that the angel would take care of him. And that's the kind of spirit that we want to go home with from our Bible school this year. Look at another case in Abraham's life. This is the one with Hagar. When Hagar got sent away and got frustrated, right, she takes off in Genesis 16. But the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness on the way to Shur and said to her, you know, "Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from? Where are you going?" And she said, "I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." Now the angel knew all this. When the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand." Then the angel of the Lord said to her, "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction." And what was happening in her life at this point. Now, that's the kind of compassion that angels have in how they deal with people. This was Hagar that the angel was dealing with, and promising Hagar that the angels would take care of her. But Hagar had to follow the directions, and she did. In Genesis 17, we find that when the angels pick up Abraham when he's 99 years old, and the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, "I'm Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. I'll make my covenant between me and you. Abraham falls on his face in verse 3, and God talked with him, saying. Say, this is an angel talking with Abraham at this point. And when he had finished talking with him, God went up. I mean, see, that's where you find these things. These are angels that had come down from heaven. They appear, they talk to Abraham, and then they depart. They leave from Abraham, and he doesn't see their presence anymore at that point. But this was such an important event that the angels appeared to Abraham to confirm the covenant with him and let him know that he would have a son. And then in Genesis 18, when the Lord appeared to him now, or you know, the three men actually show up, this is probably one of the first stories I ever got into, was fascinated about angels. Because the Lord appeared to him in verse 1 as he's sitting there in the tent of the door in the heat of the day, and he lifts up his eyes, he's like, there's three men standing there, and they're called Yahweh. And this is what fascinated me in terms of like God manifestation and how he empowers these angels. So the three men are standing there, and they run from the tents. Abraham goes over to meet him, bows himself to the ground, you know, and he says, please let a little water be brought, wash your feet, rest yourselves under the tree. He's going to take care of these people. These are like entertaining angels unawares. I'm not sure at this point Abraham even knew they were angels at this point, but he's still going to befriend them and take care of them and entertaining angels. And he asked for them to eat, you know. So he says, look, will you at least, I'll make you a meal. Now, can you imagine how long that took for Abraham to go back there and make a meal and come back and serve it to them? This is the kind of patience angels have. They're not like rush, rush, hurry, 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 we've got to get this done. The angels have unbelievable patience with us so that they can accomplish their goals within our time frame and something we can understand. I find that fascinating, angels. That's the kind of character we want to be working on now. Patience with people. Patience in our ecclesias. This is what angels do and how they treat people. They accommodated Abraham's wishes. You know, and you know how the story goes on in verse 12, that Sarah laughed within herself, saying, if I've grown old, will I have pleasure? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? They can read her thoughts. They know what she's thinking, and that she's laughing within herself. But at the same time, they also know that she obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. I mean, this is the good news. Sometimes we do make mistakes, but the angels, in reading our thoughts, they know what we're thinking, they know our attitude of mind, and they also know what we think about our spouse. That's really interesting, isn't it? That they knew that she had called him Lord in her head. And so it really does make you wonder, brothers and sisters, about how we live, how we think about each other. They know what we think about each other. Our kids, our parents, our spouses, our ecclesial members, they read our thoughts. And they're looking for people who want to live as members of God's family, who learn to train their thoughts like that so we think as members of God's family. That's what angels do. Now, we'll probably leave it there for today, but just to some of the lessons that you can pick up from this part of the story so far today, that let's thank God in Christ for sending his angels to minister for us every day. And I say thank Christ because they're his angels now. He now is in control of the angels. And that he sends them out to help us day by day, and that they do encamp around those who fear him and deliver them. But beware of the fact that the eyes of the Lord, those angels, are in every place beholding the good and the evil. They are aware of what we're doing, why we're doing it, and what we are thinking while we're doing it. Which is not bad, it's good, because they have to fix those things in our character that are wrong. And right now is the time, and I'll keep saying it all week, this is the time to practice living like angels. If we hope to be members of God's family forever and join them in their work, it's got to start now. Thanks.